please reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. This afternoon, we'll call our first case and only case for this afternoon, 03-1855, Patrick G. Schilling v. State of Wisconsin Crime Victims' Rights Board. Arguing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin Crime Victims' Rights Board is Bruce A. Olson, Assistant Attorney General. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Early in the morning on October 14th, 1999, the phone rang in the Price County Sheriff's Department 911 Center. On the other end of the line was a young boy, only 10, who with his younger brother had woken to discover their mother's murdered body shot dead in her bed. The raw horror of that boy's fresh discovery was captured on audio tape pursuant to the policies of the department. Jennifer Marenko was survived by her two young sons, her mother, and 9 siblings. The shock of their loss and the pain of their grief were soon turned to anger and frustration when they learned that Jennifer's former husband, the boy's own father, not in custody, even though he had 2 felony charges pending against him, was charged with first-degree homicide and armed burglary with a dangerous weapon. The murder case against Mr. Marenko proceeded slowly. 10 months after Jennifer's death, the case hadn't been scheduled yet. About a year after, during that time, the family's relationship with the district attorney had deteriorated to the point where, on October 31st, 2000, they picketed outside the Price County Courthouse, complaining about the length of time it was taking to set a trial date. That trial date was picked that day for March 2001. During the 4 months intervening, the family's relationship did not really improve. During that time, the family members came to believe that the district attorney was refusing to confer with them. On March 8th, finally, after 4 days of trial, a conviction was entered against Daniel Marenko on both the homicide and the burglary counts. The 911 tape was not played at the trial. Sentencing was set for April 12, 2001. Many of Jennifer's family members were present at that hearing. The district attorney had checked with the family to make sure that Jennifer's 2 young sons would not be present.
Just on the facts, you said it wasn't played. Does that mean that it could have been played?
It means that I don't know if it could have been played or it could not have been played.
But would there be some evidentiary questions about the content of the tape as far as inflaming the jury?
There could be, certainly.
And there are different considerations when you, go before the sentencing judge. You can use different pieces of evidence, correct?
Certainly, yeah, the sentencing is a very different proceeding than a trial is, and I would expect that the rules of evidence would not necessarily apply to what gets presented to the court at sentencing. During the course of that sentencing hearing, the district attorney, without telling the members of Jennifer Marenko's family that he was going to play the tape and without giving them the opportunity to leave the courtroom, hit the play button.
Sir, do you mean to imply that he had the obligation to tell them what he was going to do at sentencing when arguing for a maximum sentence in this crime?
That is what the Crime Victim Rights Board held, that he was obligated.
But he had an obligation to tell them in advance what he was going to do.
Even if it is just at as the hearing begins, I'm going to play this tape at the hearing. You might find it very upsetting. I'll give you a chance.
I want to focus my question a little bit more broadly. I'm trying to figure out whether your argument is specific to this tape, which leads me to other questions, or whether he was supposed to tell them, in your view, what he was going to be doing at sentencing in a more general sense. In other words, I'm going to argue this and that. I'm going to show pictures of the victim. I'm going to, all the other things he might be doing in addition to this tape. Yeah. Is it more broad or just specifically this tape?
Well, the prosecutor has the duty to confer with a victim, and all of these family members are victims.
True, but
at their request.
But does that obligation include telling him what he's going to do? That's what's troubling me. What does confer mean, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask you.
I think confer means, it does mean that in a general sense, you know, what he is going to do and something about the case. Obviously, there are reasons why he would not want to jeopardize the presentation of evidence, and that makes certainly good reason. But after the trial, there's less reason for keeping that kind of confidentiality.
But wouldn't the opposing counsel like to know what's going to happen at sentencing as well as during the trial?
The opposing counsel, I don't believe, has any rights as a victim, unlike the victims.
I agree with that. But once you tell the victim that does the victims, it doesn't necessarily, you don't necessarily have control over that information anymore, correct?
That's true. That's why one of the options is to present that information to the family at the beginning of the sentencing hearing, when the risk that the family will communicate something that will later prejudice the prosecution's presentation of his argument.
Could the family then veto what the district attorney was going to do if they found it was harmful to their sensibilities?
No, I don't believe so. Certainly the board has never held that.
Then what would be the sense in his telling them he's going to play this tape if they couldn't tell him, don't play it?
To fulfill his duty to treat them with fairness, dignity, and respect for their privacy.
They could have left proceeding, right?
Yeah, they
could. And not listened to the tape?
They could have had they known that the tape was going to be played. But once the play button is hit, the child's voice appears on the tape.
So you started your presentation with the fact that, and I guess when I read this, I thought there were strained relations, but I guess I missed the fact that they had picketed, and that was all over the fact that this case was not progressing fast enough. Is that?
In the family's view, that was certainly their view, that it wasn't progressing fast enough.
Now, in reviewing the record, is that was that legitimate? In other words, so you had the defense counsel, of course, and having been a trial judge, and this is a case of some magnitude, you have the judge setting his or her calendar. Here it was a his. You have the defense counsel. You have to fit all of these in. Are you saying that the 1 year was an excessive time? I mean, just in your experience, or strike that?
The family made an allegation, the complainants in this case made an allegation that the prosecutor failed to honor their rights to a speedy disposition of the case. The board heard testimony on that matter and rejected that argument. So the board does not believe that that their rights to a speedy disposition were violated. This is the court's first opportunity to interpret Article 1, Section 9M. It is one of the more recent additions to our Declaration of Rights in the Wisconsin Constitution. Unlike, of course, the federal Constitution, which creates a limited government, typically state constitutions create governments of general power. And the articles in the Constitution are to be construed as restrictions on legislative action. All the other articles in Article 1 are along those lines, creating individual rights or restricting the power of the legislature to interfere with citizens' rights. Article 1, Section 9M is no exception. The sentence in question in this case is the first sentence, that this state shall treat crime victims as defined by law with fairness, dignity, and respect for their privacy. It is a...
What part of that phrase was violated by playing this tape, Counselor?
All three of the operative elements, fairness, dignity, and respect for their privacy.
Okay, how was it unfair to them?
The family members who were subjected to the tape were treated differently than the family members who were expressly excused from the hearing, or the prosecutor made sure that they wouldn't be there. The boys, who are victims, equally with the family members, the other family members.
But they were children.
True.
Were there any other children present?
The record does not reflect that.
Okay.
But their status as victims was equal.
So it was unfair to the adults that they were treated differently than the children, because all of them were victims.
That's correct.
Okay. And how else was it a violation of the constitutional provisions?
They violated their rights to be treated with dignity.
And how did that do that?
In the sense that they are autonomous individuals capable of making choice. If given that choice, they were not given the option of being subjected to the tape recording, the very upsetting tape recording that they should have been given.
So they would have left if they knew it was going to be played? Is that the deal? I mean, is that why the choice they wanted to have?
The record doesn't reflect whether they would have wanted to stay or would not have wanted to stay. I assume that they would prefer not to have heard the tape since they complained that it was played.
But they didn't say that they would leave.
I'm sorry?
They didn't say that they would leave during the course of the hearings that have been held on this.
No, my understanding is that they remained during the course of the tape being played.
And the last provision, I guess it is treating them with dignity. How did this not treat them with dignity to play this tape?
I think I mentioned dignity first. They are autonomous individuals capable of making choice. Respect for privacy.
Privacy, thank you.
They are subjected to the tape in the most public of settings, a sentencing hearing at trial. This was their nephews, their grandchildren, who are on this tape, who are reporting the death of their mother, another relative. This is tremendously upsetting by all accounts, including the trial judge's account.
Well, I would imagine the whole trial was very upsetting, wasn't it? I mean, in the intent of the trial, a murder trial's got to be upsetting to the victims.
Absolutely. I'm sure that the trial was upsetting to them, but that was not a complaint that was made. The complaint that was made was that the playing of this 911 tape subjected them to its raw power that they had never heard before in the most public of settings.
Mr. Olson.
Thank you.
With respect to the constitutional provision and how far this reaches under your position, what we're talking about here arguably is a tactical decision of a district attorney in how to proceed at a sentencing proceeding. And your point is that by not discussing that tactical decision with family members in advance and giving them an opportunity to leave, that violated their constitutional rights here. What other types of tactical decisions would have to be discussed with family members in proceeding with a trial?
I'm not sure that I'm able to answer that question today for a couple of reasons. One, this is the first case that has come before this court on this constitutional provision, and its outlines have not been subjected to judicial interpretation. Two, I represent the Crime Victim Rights Board, which hears individual quasi-judicial cases and makes decisions based on the entire set of circumstances that it hears as part of the hearing. I'm not exactly sure what cases in the future they might decide will violate people's rights, or which decisions by prosecutors will have to be communicated to family members in advance.
Were there photographs of the scene?
The trial record does not, the record in this case does not reflect that. I believe there were.
If the prosecutor had wanted to show photographs of the deceased at the sentencing hearing, would the prosecutor have had to confer with the victims on that?
Without knowing, given the other circumstances in this case, the strained relationships between or the prosecutor and the family members or
your position, Mr. Olson, is that the constitutional provision is completely clear. So what's the answer?
It certainly is clear in the fact that it creates treatment responsibilities by the state. That part is clear. This state shall treat crime victims with fairness, dignity, and respect. That part is clear. The application of that, of course, depends on particular facts and circumstances that I'm really not able to completely conjure up at this moment at the podium.
Well, suppose there had been a transcript of the 911 tape, and the district attorney had read from the transcript. Any different result?
I don't know the answer to that. One would think that it may have a different result because voices tend to invoke greater emotional reaction than written words do, though not always, and not always with every person. I think that if those were the facts that were presented to the board, it would have to make its decision based upon those facts.
Could I ask you, decision of the Crime Victims Board was very critical of the public defender in this case. Is that appropriate?
I'm not sure that I'm able to respond to the question. It's true that the board was critical of the defense lawyer in this case, and that appears, I believe, in its opinion and in some of the findings of fact.
The amendment says this state shall treat crime victims with fairness, dignity, and respect. What does the state mean?
I think that I'm not sure its entire scope, but I assume that the state means, since the state does not itself act alone, it acts through its agents, the amendment would mean agents of the state. Whether that extends to criminal defense lawyers, I think I don't know the answer to that.
Well, if it was
what I do know is that my board has jurisdiction to hear complaints from public officials and agencies and public agencies. Now, whether public defenders would fit that definition of public official, I think may be doubtful, in part because the fourth sentence of the amendment says that nothing in the amendment or any statute enacted pursuant to it shall impinge on the rights of criminal defendants. I would expect that the first duty of a criminal defense lawyer would be to his or her client.
Well, the statute doesn't define state, but it clearly has other provisions that include judges. Should the judge have stopped the playing of this tape?
That was not an issue that was presented to the board. Had that claim been made, the board would have had to make findings and make a decision based on the evidence that it heard. But it did not have to reach that issue, and I don't think I can substitute my judgment for the board this afternoon.
Mr. Olson, what deference, if any, do you feel is owed to the decisions of the board in this case?
In this particular case, none. This court is the ultimate interpreter of our Constitution.
So this is really a de novo review?
I can tell you this was the board's very first hearing. That's probably not in the record, but it is undisputed. There is no background from which this court might give deference to the board if it had sort of a long history of interpretations of this. That day may come, not today.
Do we owe any deference to their findings of fact?
I believe you do owe deference to their findings of fact. The facts in this case were stipulated to. That's why the record in this case is as pleasantly thin as it is.
I have one other question. If the district attorney utilized a victim witness coordinator to consult with the family, I'm assuming that meets what the board would feel are the requirements under the constitutional amendment and under the statutes. Is that correct?
I believe that the statutes do permit district attorneys to use victim witness coordinators to discharge the DA's duties, and I would expect that the board would consider that to be a sufficient discharge of the prosecutor's duties.
Was there such a coordinator in Price County?
There was a coordinator in Price County, though Mr. Schilling did not tell her that he was going to play the tape, and she had not heard it either until it was played at the sentencing hearing.
Thank you.
Counsel, as I see the issue, it's not whether what was done was treating someone, that is, victims, with dignity and respect. I suppose maybe reasonable minds have different perspectives on that, maybe not. But the issue is whether or not the first sentence in Article 1, Section 9M creates a distinct enforceable right, or whether it's prefatory or preamble-like language. That's how I see the issue. Is that what you see as the issue?
I think that is the right way to look at the issue, yes.
Now, in just reading it, you know, if I had done nothing else but read this, I'd look at it and I would say to myself, that reminds me of the, you know, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, you know, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, which is the preamble to the Constitution of the United States, and similarly to our Wisconsin Constitution. That's prefatory. That's preamble. It doesn't create a distinct enforceable right, but rather sets forth the purpose. And I see in this amendment, in my mind, that same kind of structure. The first sentence saying the state shall treat crime victims with fairness, dignity, and respect for their privacy. And like the state and federal constitutions, after you do the preamble, then you get to the specifics. And this amendment then gets to the specifics with regard to the following privileges and protections. Here it is. Number one, timely disposition of the case. Number two, the opportunity to attend. So very specific with regards to the rights. Why am I reading it incorrectly if I read that first sentence to be prefatory or purpose or preamble?
This Court is by its decisions, looks at the language of the amendment in its context, looks to the constitutional debates, if there are any. There aren't any in this case, so the closest thing would be the legislative history of the joint resolutions that preceded sending this to the voters for approval. And then to the first enactment after the passage of the amendment. The structure of the amendment is fairly complicated. It includes both mandatory provisions and those which are directory in the sense that they instruct the legislature to say that the legislature shall provide the state shall ensure that crime victims have all the privileges and protections as provided by law. That's a direction to the legislature that says, in effect, you may not fail to enact statutes about timely disposition of the case. You may not fail to enact statutes that give victims the opportunity to attend court hearings. So there are some which are phrased in that as provided by law or as defined by law portions of the amendment. There are others that are strictly just directory. The first sentence contains both kinds. One is a direction to the legislature to define crime victims. This state shall treat crime victims as defined by law. That's a direction to the legislature, with fairness, dignity, and respect for privacy. If you take out the part of it that is the within the legislature's prerogative, the sentence reads, this state shall treat crime victims with fairness, dignity, and respect for privacy. It is a substantive provision of the Constitution. They are presumed to be self-executing, and this is no exception. Now, there are other, the best example of the direction to the legislature is the second sentence that says, legislature, you shall not fail to enact laws on these nine specific victim rights. The third sentence says, legislature, you may not fail to provide remedies for violations of this section, not just of the second sentence, but of this section. And the fourth sentence says, nothing in this section or any statute enacted pursuant to it shall limit the right of the accused. Well, I think that, too, is evidence that the rights in the first sentence are actual rights. Because if what that fourth sentence had said, for example, was, we know what, nothing in this section or any statute enacted pursuant to this section shall limit the right of the accused. Okay, we know what the statutes enacted pursuant to this section are. They're the remedy section and the second sentence. And the definition of crime victim. So what does that first few words, nothing in this section, as distinct from or any other statute enacted pursuant to this section, what does nothing in this section mean if not the only other thing that is operative, the treatment duty on the part of the state? That's the plain language version. Looking to the legislative history of the amendment, there was a time when the amendment was in the drafting stage, and the amendment read this. It'll take me a moment. I want to get this right. Crime victims, as defined by law, shall have rights as provided by law, including but not limited to the following. The right to be treated with fairness, dignity, and respect for their privacy throughout the criminal justice process. Now, if the framers of the amendment had wanted to just jettison the notion of a treatment duty to be treated with fairness, dignity, and respect for privacy, they would have excised that from the draft. Instead, the framers moved that right from being dependent on legislative enactment to one that is beyond the legislature's touch, up in the first sentence where it is mandatory, directory, it is mandatory and self-executing. It says this state shall treat crime victims with fairness, dignity, and respect for privacy.
Mr. Olson, if I can ask you just briefly about the respect for privacy aspect, assuming we were to accept your argument that that was created a separate right. Trials are necessarily, unless they're closed, public in nature. And I guess I'm having trouble getting to where there's a violation of respect for privacy in a public trial.
It was the effort, I believe, to invoke an emotional reaction on the part of the people present in the courtroom for the purposes of influencing the presiding judge to issue a long sentence. I think that's where the respect for privacy comes in. Playing the tape, not a problem. The problem comes in when you don't, when you already have strained relationships with the family. They believe that you're not conferring with them. In fact, you haven't conferred with them up to the course of the trial. And then at the hearing, you just hit the button and play the tape, subjecting them to, you know, private emotional moments that they may have preferred to keep private. Did prefer to keep private, or they would not have complained.
Well, they complained about other things. They complained about other things, and that was the timely disposition of the case. So it wasn't just a single incident.
No, they did complain about many aspects of this trial. I see my light is on. I don't want to overstay my
welcome. What extent does the board consider the unfortunate relationship between the family and the DA in making this decision?
I think it is. I think the board did consider it. It is part of the board's findings, and those findings made fairly expressly throughout the decision. I think it does make a difference. One of the differences it makes is that if you never talk to the family, you don't have any idea what their preferences are. Whether or not you ultimately choose to respect those preferences or not, you don't even have a baseline of information on which to make a judgment.
I understand that, but suppose, which may be hard to do, but suppose there is no strained relationship. And the same thing occurs. And let us suppose that they have been, there are complaints only about that, namely the playing of the tape. You know, it's hard for you to speculate as to the board's decision, but to, on the basis of the actual board's decision, to what extent would those factors have said no reprimand?
I'm afraid I'm going to pick the first option. I'm not going to be able to help you on
that. I'm going to phrase it differently. Just playing this tape without warning the family, giving them an opportunity to leave, is that in and of itself a violation of the Constitution? First sentence.
I don't believe, not in the context of this case. The board looked to factors beyond
that. That's what I'm really asking. Yeah. So it was an accumulation of factors.
As many of our most precious rights are, due process, for example, pretty flexible concept. You have to take into account all the facts and circumstances.
So it's the totality of the circumstances that made this act a violation.
I believe that's correct, yes. Thank you.
That's an answer to my question. Thank you very much, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thomas, is it Piper? Representing Patrick G. Schilling. We have, what is that, the constitutional amendment?
It is, Your Honor.
Do you have any objection to this constitutional amendment? And words are highlighted. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. District Attorney Schilling is certainly not here to dispute the important Wisconsin state policy underlying the Victims' Rights Amendment to treat victims with the utmost fairness and dignity and respect for their privacy. But district attorneys owe duties to many different entities in trying cases. In this case, they owed a duty, Mr. Schilling owed a duty to the citizens of Price County to make sure that Daniel Marinko was treated as severely under the law as he could be treated. He owed a duty to Jennifer Marinko to be her spokesperson in the course of the trial and its sentencing, to bring down the harshest justice upon Mr. Marinko. And he owed a duty to the crime victims, to her extended family, to treat them in accordance with the law. In order for a district attorney to be able to strategize a case, he or she needs certainty. He or she needs to know what the rights are of all of those entities in order to navigate through the often competing interests. If the interpretation of the board were adopted here, that certainty would be eliminated. That, in fact, the board would be given unfettered discretion on a case-by-case basis to make a determination as to whether a crime victim had been treated fairly or with dignity. And the lack of certainty would cause an absurd result because the vagueness of that standard would not allow that certainty that the public officials need. And it also, in this case, would interfere with the prosecutorial discretion
Mr. Piper,
of Attorney General.
Yes. If I could ask, I can think of situations when I was a trial judge where we knew that there was going to be, for lack of a better word, rather salty language coming into the courtroom. And I could look down and see children 3, 4, 5 years old sitting in the courtroom. And I recall stopping the proceedings at that point and saying, at least giving a warning to parents, you may want to take your children out of the courtroom at this moment. The language may get a little bit difficult. How difficult would that have been for Mr. Schilling to do that in this case with the family?
Well, indeed, Mr. Schilling did that very thing with the children. He realized that there's a different level of impressionism and emotional development with children. This was after a trial, after the crime scene photos, after all of the testimony and the crime victims being present, that he didn't perhaps appreciate that they should be forewarned. But the question is, did they have the right to be forewarned? A prosecutor in the middle of a trial, a defense witness is lying. The prosecutor has loaded into the laptop a picture of the crime scene that the prosecutor can show and prove indisputably that the witness is lying and at the same time impress upon the jury the grisly and gruesome nature of the crime. And the prosecutor is at a point where he or she thinks that this could be the winning moment, and the jury is there poised for the prosecutor to do something, and the prosecutor is about to push the PowerPoint, and does the prosecutor have to stop and ask for an adjournment because the prosecutor has not in advance told the victims that he or she might use that photo? Would that be fair to the citizens of Price County? Would that be fair to Jennifer Marenko in those circumstances? So the real issue in this case is, what does the constitutional provision provide? And is it self-executing? Because we have to remember the procedural posture where we are. The trial court said that the board violated both the statutes contained in Chapter 950 by sanctioning District Attorney Schilling and the constitutional provision. The board obviously understood that the trial judge was right with regard to the violation of Chapter 950, and so the board did not appeal that portion. Instead, the board appealed only the constitutional provision. So if the constitutional provision is not itself a standalone, self-executing body of law, then the analysis is over. And this court has defined when a constitutional amendment is self-executing. And the court said, in the Caden case, that a constitutional provision is in fact not self-executing if there is anything left for the legislature to do in order to give it a means or a way to have a remedy effectiveness. Now, I have highlighted in the constitutional amendment here three different instances where the legislature has to act before this amendment can become effective. The legislature must define what crime victims are to begin with. 950, as it existed prior to the amendment, was simply a Bill of Rights. And there was a very small definition of what crime victims were. The legislature, after the amendment, defined crime victims very extensively. Then the amendment goes on to say, in terms of the protections and privileges afforded crime victims, the legislature again has to act and declare, in fact, what the law is with regard to those privileges and protections. And then third, and perhaps most importantly, the amendment provides that there must be remedies for the entire section, not for some subcategory of the section. This amendment indisputably requires legislative action before it becomes enacting or effective. It is not self-executing, and the analysis should end there. But we don't need to end there because, as the board's counsel correctly stated, to interpret it, the language, in addition to its plain meaning, one looks at the first body of legislation that is promulgated after its enactment. And that's in Chapter 950. 950 has the section 950.041V, where the rights, and defined as rights, are set forth. The language that dovetails with the first sentence is in the legislative intent preamble provision of 950.01. Those are not defined as rights. The board expressly has the authority to sanction for a violation of the rights.
And none of those rights, they're just loads of them. We're up to ZX, right, as to the rights of victims in 950.04. Don't any of them deal with sentencing and other than there's something on pre-sentence investigation and et cetera, nothing that would cover this situation precisely?
The only thing that I can find is, and I agree with counsel on this, is there is a right to consult with the prosecuting attorney. That was a right that was added after the amendment, one of three rights specifically added by the amendment. But it does not say that in that consultation that, in fact, the prosecuting attorney must disclose his or her strategies nor the evidence that is going to be used.
Mr. Schilling ever consult?
He did, indeed. And I was concerned when I heard the statement, if you've never talked with the victims, you wouldn't know. That was an allegation that was, in fact, tried, and it was not found to be true, and consultation did take place. Did he consult as frequently as they requested? Probably not. But it's indisputable that consultation took place.
Your position, I suppose, is he doesn't have to consult on everything, on every.
I think it would be unmanageable if that consultation were read to mean that any time a crime victim requested to talk to the prosecutor about a case, that the prosecutor must do so.
Did they ever hear the tape under any other circumstances?
I do not know that. I do not believe so. The board has argued in its brief that the legislative history here, which was correctly cited by counsel, somehow creates a two-tier development of rights. Well, what in fact happened was the language that counsel read was that originally there had been a plan to have fairness, dignity, and respect for privacy be defined as a right. That was rejected. That was not passed. And under standard canons of construction, one would conclude that that meant that there was never an intention to make that a standalone, self-executing right. Nonetheless, the board says we have a two-tier system, and this is a higher tier. But if you look again at the legislation that was promulgated, Section 950.082RB is one of the duties that a district attorney has. And it says, what information must be provided to the victim at the outset of the case? And it reads, a list of the rights of victims under 950.041V and information about how to exercise those rights. That does not include the language of a right to be treated with fairness, dignity, and respect for privacy. One would think that if that were a right, it would be one of the rights that should be disclosed to the victims at the outset, and it is not included in that disclosure obligation. As the trial court found, there is a forfeiture provision, and the forfeiture provision is that if there is an intentional violation of the rights in subsection 41V, that the prosecutor can be fined $1,000. That does not include a violation of the preamble language to the Victim Rights Amendment. So what I think the board is really saying is if there are two tiers, that would mean this was a subordinated level of right, and that would not comport with the strong public policy that's intended to be set forth by this amendment. So what then is the purpose of the language? And the purpose of the language, I think, has been aptly portrayed recently in the Kelly B. case. The Kelly B. case was in front of this court, and this court, Justice Bradley writing, said that a mother's parental rights cannot be terminated because the mother's children are the result of being a victim of incest. And the board says, well, that's not a crime victim's case. But we have to remember the argument here is the amendment is self-executing. And if that is true, what Justice Bradley and the court and the majority said was one of the reasons that that should not be allowed, that the parental rights could be terminated, was because of the strong public policy set forth in the opening sentence of the Crime Victims' Rights Amendment. Well, if we take that to the logical extension of the board's argument, does that not mean that by terminating those parental rights, that the policy has been not upheld and therefore violated. But if that's a standalone right, can Kelly B. now file for the board a petition for sanctions against the Monroe County Corporation Council, against the Monroe County Department of Health and Social Services? Can Kelly B. ask that the matter be referred to the Judicial Commission to have the judge sanction because that violated a standalone, separate, enforceable right? And that would lead to an absurd result. That's not the intention of it. Instead, it's to be an interpretive aid. That's what Justice Prosser used it for in the Spears case, the case of the woman who had a pickpocket snatch her purse, and she ran after him and ran him down a car. And the question was, should the victim's criminal background be used in the sentencing? And in the dissent, Justice Prosser cited the strong public policy underlying the Victim's Rights Amendment. That's what it was intended to be used for, and that's the appropriate use. In the amicus case, cases cited by the amicus in this case, they cited a number of cases from other jurisdictions. Same type of language. In New Jersey, the question was, does the right to fairness and to be treated with dignity provide a victim the opportunity to have standing to request a closed hearing, that the victim's hardship be considered on venue issues? In the Texas McDonald case, in fact, the court held that that language did not give the victim the right to access to the prosecutor's evidence. But that's what the argument is being made here, is the prosecutor has a duty because of the standalone, self-executing fairness standard to share the evidence in advance of a hearing, whether it's a sentencing hearing or a trial.
Would it be fair to say that your position in interpretation is that victims have only procedural rights?
Well, I don't view the rights that are set forth in 950 as only procedural. I mean, the right to be able to speak at a sentencing hearing, or, well, particularly at a sentencing hearing, it is procedural to the extent that they get an invitation to come, but it is a substantive right to make a declaration and make your feelings known for the sentence of the person who has violated you as a victim. So whether it be substantive or procedural, it is our position that the rights for which a prosecutor or a judge or a agency can be sanctioned by the board are those specific rights that are set forth in .041V. Whether they're procedural or some substantive, they are not broader than that. In interpreting what a victim can do in a hearing, if it isn't a specific right that is listed, for instance, ask for a closed hearing, can you use the preamble portion as an interpretive aid to give them a procedural right that might not be listed? Yes, I think you can. I think that's what the courts have done, and I think that's what this court has done, is rely on a strong public policy to aid victims. But that is a far cry from sanctioning someone for violating a fairness standard. And in fact, it causes very problematic interpretation for the court. The vagueness standard is real. It would lead to an absurd result here. Now, the argument has been made, how can you say that a constitutional amendment is unconstitutional? Well, it may be unconstitutional under the United States Constitution, but that's not the specific argument we're making. You need to avoid that absurd result, because how does one legislate fairness? How does one legislate that someone must be treated with dignity? What are the standards to be used to make that determination? in the Gauguin case that we cited to the court, U.S. Supreme Court, somewhat infamous case arising out of the Vietnam era, the statute said that the flag of the United States cannot be treated contemptuously. Well, that's pretty close to treating somebody with dignity. And a young man had the flag on the seat of his jeans and was prosecuted for it. And the Supreme Court said that if a statute would give unfettered discretion to the finder of fact or the person who would be implementing the provision, then it is unduly vague and unenforceable. That exact concern was raised here by the Court of Appeals when it certified the case to this court. The court said, as interpreted by the board, the constitutional language via WSSTAT Chapter 950 gives the board largely unlimited power to sanction prosecutors when the board determines a prosecutor's behavior toward a crime victim is less than respectful.
You indicate that the policy statement here can be used as an objective, and that rights that are not set forth in 950.04 can be read into the statute by the court on the basis of the policy objective. Did I get that argument correct?
No, the argument is that the policy statement can be used to define how a victim can participate in the criminal proceeding. The victim has the right to appear. The victim has the right to notice that the hearing is going to take place. It is not set forth that the victim could come in and ask that its hardship, if on a hearing on venue, should be taken into consideration if the court were to decide to change venue. That's one of the cases that the amici cited. And the court could say, in that circumstance, it doesn't say here that venue is an issue to be addressed, but they need to be treated with fairness, dignity, and respect for their privacy. But is it fair to move a trial from an area where the victims can't be present? I think that can be done. I think it has been done. But that, again, is far different than sanctioning a prosecutor on the sole basis that he or she did not treat somebody fairly. The standards simply aren't there. And the last issue we've raised in our brief is the significant infringement on prosecutorial discretion. One of the most guarded, and in the Ford case, this court talked about it, rights of a prosecutor is how and when to use evidence. And if, in fact, a prosecutor had an obligation, however disturbing the evidence, to go to the victims in all cases and tell the victims what evidence he or she intended to use at a particular point in time, that would definitely interfere with the prosecutorial discretion. Now, Judge Nowakowski said, well, here the defense counsel knew about the tape, so it wouldn't have been a surprise. You don't have to worry about strategic decision. And you could have called an adjournment. You could have talked to them on the way in and let them know. So there are limitations. It's only under limited circumstances. But the board does not have the right to in any way impinge upon prosecutorial discretion. The court has made it clear that's a legislative determination. The legislature can put a restriction on prosecutorial discretion. The board cannot. And you can't say, well, it's a little bit of an infringement, but not that harsh in this case, if it is an infringement that goes beyond what the board had the authority to do.
Mr. Piper, if I could, I'm concerned, and I think I indicated this in questions to Mr. Olson, with the reach of the constitutional provision that's cited here and how far it goes into a trial state. It's been my experience that whether we're talking about district attorneys or other attorneys for that matter, there's not always agreement with how a case should be handled. You have victims, because the district attorney's office is representing the people of the state of Wisconsin, not necessarily the victims in that. They're not the victim's attorney. They have to be cognizant of victims' rights. But as a result, sometimes there's disagreements on how cases should be handled, The victims want it handled a particular way. The district attorney thinks it should be handled another. How does the decision of the board here impact on some of those disagreements that are necessarily built into the system?
Well, could under the board's ruling here, could the board in some case where a victim says, I did not want you to say this about my sister. I did not want you to say this about my daughter. And therefore, I filed a complaint, and I think that I was not treated fairly. It reminds me of my children growing up, how many times I was accused of not treating them fairly. It's such an amorphous standard, I don't know how it would be implemented. I think the case law is very clear that I know of no crime victims' rights statutes in the country that have ever given victims a right to veto the prosecution's decision-making. But if we adopt this as a self-executing, independent of Chapter 950, a self-executing amendment provision, could the board in a particular case decide that the strategy adopted in advance by the prosecutor without prior disclosure to a victim mean that the victims had not been treated fairly or with dignity? I believe it goes that far. And I believe that's why this was never intended to be a self-executing provision. Instead, the certainty was provided by what exact rights exist in the statute so that there wouldn't be the discussions over what does fairness mean, what does dignity mean, what does respect for privacy mean. It means the specific time and manner that is set forth in the statute. The victims here had the right to know the hearing was going on. A sentencing hearing by its very nature is emotionally charged. That's why it's taking place. Both sides want to give their emotional positions and arguments. And the victims had the right to decide not to come or to come, but then to come and have the district attorney use powerful evidence to try to further the rights of Price County citizens and Jennifer Marinko to get this person put away for as long as he possibly could, to say that I not only had the right set forth in the statute to know the hearing was going on, I should have been told what evidence you were going to present in advance. So I
end by Mr. Piper, is there some provision in the statutes for representation of persons who are complained against? Very often the state defends public officials, but that doesn't seem to be the case here either.
Why am I here?
Who's paying your bill?
Put it simply.
There was a conflict because of the Attorney General's office representing the board, and therefore I was appointed through the governor's office, which is how, when there is a conflict so that the Attorney General's office cannot represent a particular person, then it is up to the governor as part of the governor's statutory powers to decide who he or she chooses, and I got the luck of the draw.
So that, in essence, the answer to Justice Prosser's question is the state represents the district attorney, but the state usually does representation through the AG's office. They already represent a party, so you represent the DA.
Yes, Justice Abramson. Yes. I end where I begin.
The state's on both sides of this case with different counsel.
Well, they're pocketbooks.
I would not say that because.
What would you say?
I would say that District Attorney Schilling is on the other side because he personally is being subjected to a reprimand that affects his personal standing.
Right, and he's represented by the state.
That's true. That is true.
All right. And what was the maximum penalty the board could have imposed on Mr. Schilling?
I don't know. I do know what it would be if our argument is correct, and that is a reprimand, because this does not fall within the category of forfeitures. because only forfeitures are for the specified right. And I believe that is the intention.
Specified right under 950.04?
1V, yes.
Okay.
That's under 950.11 is the forfeiture statute. But under an interpretation that this is a self-executing standalone provision, I'm not sure whether the board even had jurisdiction or authority, because I read this, the amendment to say that the legislature was to put remedies for all parts of the amendment, which takes it out of the self-executing category. But if we are to say, no, the first sentence stands alone, then what are the remedies? I don't know the answer.
But you recognize it may be at least a reprimand if the case goes against you.
I do indeed. It was a reprimand, and that's why the decision was to take it up, because it is a significant blemish on former District Attorney Schilling's record.
Was this confidential until Mr. Schilling took the case to court?
Yes.
So in order to defend himself, he had to go public. Is that right?
That is true. That's how much it mattered to him to have a reprimand on his record.
And that would be true in any case where someone didn't agree with the actions of the board. Is that right? They'd lose their, unless there was a public reprimand. In any private reprimand that they wanted to challenge, they would have to, in effect, make it public.
I do not know whether the board has the authority to do a public reprimand, but you're absolutely right. That is the cost to Attorney Schilling to bring this case this far, is to get a definitive answer as to whether this amendment is, in fact, self-executing. It was significant enough to him as a district attorney to have that reversed, because otherwise it is there over the heads like the sword of Damocles over all district attorneys and, in fact, over all judges, the way this interpretation is. So he forfeited his right to privacy by bringing this to first to Judge Nowakowski and then to bring it up here. So I end where I began, that this is not, he didn't bring it here to challenge the public policy as to whether these victims had the right to be treated with fairness and dignity and respect for their privacy. Instead, it should be used, however, as an interpretive guide, as a strong public policy, as this court has done now twice in Kelly B. and Spears, and we encourage the court to continue to do. But it cannot be used as a separate, standalone, enforceable right to sanction a district attorney for his choice in what evidence to use in a trial or in a hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm glad that some time was spent on the first enactment after passage of the amendment, because that was the piece that I did not get to when I was responding to Justice Bradley's questions. That first legislation, the 1997 Wisconsin Act 181, did create basically the Chapter 950 that one sees today in the statutes. And it, too, recognizes that there are constitutional rights, and that's another mechanism that the court should use in its three-factored analysis of whether of interpreting the Constitution. For example, the definition of victim in 950.02 paren 4 says that where a person is unable emotionally or physically to exercise the rights granted under Section 950.04 or Article 1, Section 9M of the Constitution. If, as Mr. Schilling is arguing today, the only rights which exist are statutory rights, then that reference to rights granted under Article 1, Section 9M is surplusage.
Counselor, couldn't it be the listed rights that are there, though? If you look beyond the first sentence, there are a number of rights that are there that are
specifically identified. So couldn't it be referring back to those rights?
Not, I think, on the prosecution's theory that in order for those, for the rights in the second sentence, for those privileges and protections in the second sentence to become operative, the legislative action is needed.
Right, I understand that, but I think that you can read them in concert rather than being separated. In other words, that the rights start out being provided in the Constitution and are certainly made much more specific in Chapter 950. I mean, there are many more in 1V than are certainly indicated you may find in the statutes if you just read the Section 1M, correct?
I think that really brings us back to the kind of the fundamental constitutional structure of this state, that the, you know, the constitutional theory is that individuals exist in a state of nature. They have lots of freedom, but no mechanism for securing it. And so in order to secure their liberties, they form governments. Mm-hmm. Some of their rights they entrust to government through the enactment of positive legislation. Those are the rights in the second sentence. Some rights they retain to themselves beyond the reach of the legislature. Those are, for example, the right to due process, the right to equal protection, the right against slavery, the right to just compensation when property is taken for a public purpose. It kind of goes on and on and on, the list of specific rights that are retained by the people beyond the reach of the legislature. This amendment is structured exactly as those other rights are, in the affirmative rather than the negative, but to the same effect, that they are, that it is an expression of rights that are retained by the people beyond the reach of the legislature.
Mr. Olson, in the certification from the Court of Appeals, there is reference to the fact that if we adopt your interpretation of the constitutional amendment, that there would have to be a limiting interpretation. Do you agree with that?
I agree that the rights stated in Article 1 are stated broadly, as are many of the ideals in Article 1. Ultimately, I'm sure, there is going to be additional attention that needs to be paid to these amendments. If the court determines that there is that they create enforceable rights, I don't know that I would consider that a limiting interpretation. I think it is just the position that a court finds itself when it is faced for the first time with a brand new constitutional amendment, which it has never seen before, which has not been litigated in other jurisdictions. We don't have a long tradition of English common law on which to fall back. It is the beginning of a conversation, not the end.
Mr. Olson, if I could, along that line, looking again at the scope, oftentimes you have situations where a district attorney disagrees with a victim or victims with respect to the handling of the case that goes towards the area of plea bargain. And assume for sake of the question, the district attorney may have enough evidence to go to trial on the greater charge, but makes a tactical decision, a decision evaluating the case, that it makes more sense to plead this down to a lesser charge to get the certainty of the conviction and discusses it with the family, and the family strongly objects and says, no, we think this case should go to trial on a greater charge. If the district attorney then follows through with the plea bargain, has the district attorney been unconstitutionally unfair to the victims?
I don't believe, I can only answer that by frankly relying on extra record information that I have because I represent the Crime Victim Rights Board. Well, what I can tell you is how the board has interpreted the constitutional amendment in other cases, not before this court. You don't have the record before the court. If you'll indulge me that, I can tell you. And that is that the board does not believe that victims have the right to veto strategic decisions made by district attorneys about whether to plea bargain cases, whether to put on particular pieces of evidence in the course of a trial, whether a police investigation is adequate or not. The board has decided that those are just issues that are beyond its scope.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Thank you, Mr. Piper. Thank you, Mr. Olson, for your illuminating discussion of an issue this court has not had before. That concludes our hearing on 03-1855, Schilling versus State of Wisconsin Crime Victims Rights Board. The court will meet in closed conference at 10 after 3. Thank you.